This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm David Biancooley of TVWorthWatching.com, in for Terry Gross. There's a new plan aimed at engineering a Republican takeover of state legislatures, with the expectation that it will have a ripple effect on national politics. In the current edition of The New Yorker, our first guest, Jane Mayer, writes about how this strategy has played out successfully in the battleground state of North Carolina. After the 2010 election, both chambers of that state's General Assembly were left with firm Republican majorities for the first time since 1870. Her article, State for Sale, is about a conservative multimillionaire named Art Pope. Pope, his family, and their organizations targeted 22 legislative races. The Republicans they backed won 18 of those seats. Pope has financial ties to Americans for Prosperity, a national Tea Party group which was founded by David Koch. Last year, Mayer wrote an article in The New Yorker about David and his brother Charles Koch and their role in funding conservative causes, including the Tea Party movement. Terry spoke with Jane Mayer last week.
Jane Mayer, welcome to Fresh Air. Now, the North Carolina strategy that you're writing about of getting more Republicans in the state house, this is part of a larger plan called REDMAP. What is REDMAP engineered to do?
Well, REDMAP was a project that was launched by something called the Republican State Leadership Committee. And the idea was to flip as many state houses across the country to Republican majorities as was possible in 2010, and particularly those states where redistricting was going to take place, congressional redistricting. And the thinking behind it, which was very ingenious, was that state races, things like, you know, state legislature races, are cheap. And if you can just put a bit of money into them and flip the state house, then you can control the redistricting process, which in turn gives the Republican Party a great advantage in putting members of Congress in the House of Representatives.
So how did you find out about REDMAP? Is REDMAP common knowledge, or is it more of a more secretive kind of strategy?
It wasn't secret, but basically what I found was that most people don't pay a lot of attention to what's going on in the states, especially these days with the news media having to watch its budgets. There are an awful lot of state houses that are no longer covered, and there's just not a lot of focus on what's going on at that granular level in this country. It's kind of ground zero for where politics is playing out, but still not a lot of people watch it.
Okay, so your focus is on North Carolina and this REDMAP strategy in North Carolina to have Republicans take over the state legislature, you know, have a majority in the state legislature. Why is North Carolina so important within the larger REDMAP strategy?
Well, North Carolina is a really key state for 2012, the presidential election year. And the reason is it's a state that traditionally teeters between Republican and Democratic. And in 2008, Obama carried it, and he carried it very narrowly with just over 14,000 votes. It is considered by almost any analyst you talk to be a must-win state for Obama in 2012. If you take a look at the map, he's going to have to try to carry it again. So what happens there may have a kind of a final effect, a very important decisive effect in the presidential election.
My guest is Jane Mayer, staff writer for The New Yorker, and her new article is called State for Sale, A Conservative Multimillionaire Has Taken Control of North Carolina, One of 2012's Top Battlegrounds. So the conservative millionaire mentioned in your headline is Art Pope, and he's the chair and CEO of Variety Wholesalers, which you describe as a discount store conglomerate. Give us a sense of how much money he and the foundations and organizations that he's behind have sunk into elections in North Carolina.
Well, he has himself a family foundation with about $150 million in it. And over the past decade, he and his company and you know, a couple members of his family have basically poured money into the state's politics. $40 million is about what they've spent through their foundations. About $35 million of that has gone towards pushing a far-right political agenda in North Carolina. And in this past election, he and the groups that he helped found spent $2.2 million. And again, it doesn't sound like a lot nationally, but it can make all the difference in the context of one state. So basically what you're looking at is one very wealthy corporate captain who, when motivated enough, can exert enormous influence in a state.
Yeah, you write that three-quarters of the spending by independent groups in North Carolina's 2010 state races came from accounts linked to this one man, Art Pope.
Three-quarters of the spending, exactly, of outside groups. And they're supposed to be independent groups, and they're supposed to be nonpartisan for the most part. And yet so much of the money, when you take a close look at it, is linked back to this one man, Art Pope.
So let's look at some of the groups that Art Pope has created or co-created and has donated a lot of money to. Let's start with Real Jobs North Carolina. What is the purpose of that?
Real Jobs North Carolina is basically just a campaign group. It's an entity that exists to accept corporate donations mostly from companies like Art Pope's and spend them in campaigns in the state. And it targeted the Democrats and ran nasty ads against them.
How about the group Civitas Action?
Civitas Action is an organization that is an offshoot of a think tank that Art Pope runs, and 95% of the funds come from Pope and his other organizations, his business, whatever. And it exists to target Democrats.
And what's the think tank?
The think tank is one of several he runs. He has this kind of amazingly well-oiled political machine, which he would describe as not political. He would say it is nonpartisan and policy-oriented. It pushes a conservative agenda by studying issues, by educating people to help turn them into candidates, by helping train them as candidates, and by judging the work of the legislature and basically publishing scorecards. And by doing a lot of polling too, and polls that usually end up pushing conservative issues.
So, is it more activist than the description that you just gave?
I mean, you know, this is a matter of debate. I mean, one of the things that was complicated in writing about this subject is that the laws are really blurry at this point, and they're also really badly enforced when it comes to what's a violation of the IRS codes. These entities are supposed to be social welfare organizations that are nonpartisan in their nature. And because of that, when people donate to them, they get tax write-offs. But the question of what's partisan and what's not is to some extent in the eyes of the beholder. And Art Pope would argue that these are nonpartisan entities.
Now, the Citizens United Supreme Court decision has really opened the doors for individuals like Art Pope and organizations like the ones he runs to give a lot more money to candidates. So would you explain the doors that Citizens United opened for Art Pope's groups?
Basically, what it does is it gives a green light to corporations to spend money directly for and against candidates. And it also makes clear to somebody like Art Pope that there are not going to be legal repercussions for pouring money into campaigns. And again, he would say he's just educating people about issues. But if he crosses a line, he's not going to get in trouble by doing so, since Citizens United. And in a way, what it's done is it's enabled anybody with access to a corporate treasury to spend almost bottomless amounts of money. And it's a particularly helpful ruling for businessmen who own their own companies, which Art Pope does. This is a privately held company, much like the Kochs have a privately held family company. So they have control over the treasuries, and they don't have to answer to stockholders.
I see. That's why the privately held company is different, because they don't have stockholders to answer to.
Right. And so it really allows him to make these decisions pretty much single-handedly.
Now, it's interesting that Art Pope helped fund the legal center run by James Bopp, the lawyer who made the initial filing in the Citizens United case. So does that have implications?
Well, I thought so. I mean, stepping back, what I was trying to look at is where did this push to enable corporations to play such a bigger role come from? And how's it affecting American politics? And one of the things that interested me is that the corporate captains like Art Pope are the ones who have funded the legal push to get rid of campaign finance rules and restrictions. So from the start, he's been trying to gut public campaign financing. He calls it welfare for politicians. And what his critics say is he doesn't believe in public financed elections. He believes in Pope financed elections. And so it gives him a lot more power if he can spend all that money.
Last year, you wrote an article about the Koch brothers, two very wealthy brothers who have given a lot of support to the Tea Party movement and other very conservative causes. Art Pope is connected to the Koch brothers. What is the connection?
Well, among other things, they've been friends for something like 25 years, and they've coordinated to some extent. They Art Pope goes to their sort of secret confabs that the Kochs run twice a year, and by invitation only, where everyone is sworn to secrecy and not allowed to talk about what takes place. But Pope has gone to many of them, and in those conferences, what they do is think about where to put their money. And to a certain extent, what really caught my interest was that what the country is seeing is what looks like a kind of spontaneous combustion of far right wing Tea Party politics. But behind that, there are some very instrumental players who have great family fortunes, corporate fortunes, and who are coordinating to some extent. And Art Pope is one of the players. The Koch brothers are two more.
So it sounds like the Koch brothers have given to Art Pope's group, but that Art Pope's group has given to the Koch brothers.
Well, that's true. And he was praised recently by one of the Kochs for his contributions. There are a couple organizations that are national that really are kind of Tea Party organizing groups. And one of them is Americans for Prosperity, it's called. And it was founded by David Koch in 2004. And Art Pope is one of four directors. So he's a key player in this national Tea Party organizing effort, and he's worked very closely with the Kochs in doing so.
So now that the red map strategy appears to have succeeded in North Carolina, the strategy of having Republicans dominate the state house, and the strategy has succeeded in North Carolina with the help of funding by Art Pope and his organizations and foundations, Republicans in the state legislature have proposed new voting eligibility laws, laws that critics say would limit the voting rights largely of Democrats. What are these laws that have been proposed by Republicans in North Carolina?
What they've been talking about doing is requiring voters to produce state photo IDs, and that's one part of it. So you have to have the right kind of identification with you, which the critics say is much more of a problem generally for students and poor people who often tend to vote Democratic. Another thing that they're contemplating doing is closing down the window of time during which people can vote. They had the polls open for extra time during 2008 so that people, for instance, who worked could vote on Sundays, and there were extra weeks open so you could vote early. There's a push to close down this window. And, I interviewed Art Pope at some length, and he was pretty clear that he felt that the Democrats outfoxed the Republicans by allowing all of this kind of open voting in 2008. And that was one of the things that really gave Obama the edge. So they've got it in their sights, and they're planning to do whatever they can do to sort of close it off. I mean, they're saying that it's all about ending voter fraud, but I don't think they've been able to produce any serious examples of vote fraud.
Your article is titled State for Sale. Do you think that there are more states becoming for sale in the same way that you describe North Carolina as having been for sale? And do you think we're becoming a nation for sale? Do you think that elections are getting more controlled by big money?
Well, I think you certainly can see the numbers are just going up and up and up, and money's becoming more and more kind of spectacular in the sums that are being spent. So, I'd have to take a look at every state before I could say that it's you know, the same story in every state. But certainly I think this is a cautionary tale. And, at the end of the day, I think it poses some very deep questions in the country because, you know, I go back to thinking about somebody like Louis Brandeis, who said you can either have concentrations of great wealth or you can have a democracy, but you can't have both. And there's a tension between the idea of one man, one vote, and spending huge buckets of money by a few people. And I guess we're sort of watching it play out there.
Jane Mayer, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Terry.
Jane Mayer speaking with Terry Gross. Mayer's article, State for Sale, is in the current edition of The New Yorker. There's a link to it on our website, freshair.npr.org. Many of us felt an almost personal sense of loss when Steve Jobs died this week, because his work transformed not only computer technology, but our lives. He was a visionary. He co-founded Apple and played a key role in the creation of the Mac, the iPod, iTunes, the iPhone, the iPad, and many other technologies which rival companies have done their best to imitate. Jobs was 56 and had pancreatic cancer. He had a liver transplant in 2009 and stepped down as Apple's CEO last August. We're going to listen back to an excerpt of the interview Terry recorded with him in 1996, 11 years after he was ousted from Apple. Jobs returned to Apple later that same year and led the company through its most successful period and its greatest innovations.
So how do you think that the web might change in the near future?
You know, I think most large companies and medium-sized companies and even small companies are starting to look at the web as the ultimate direct-to-customer distribution channel, bypassing all middlemen, going directly from the supplier to the consumer. And that's a pretty powerful concept when you think about it. One of the things that I love is that, you know, a very small company, if they invest a lot in their website, can look just as formidable and just as solid on the web as a very large company can. And it's going to be this very leveling phenomenon.
What else do you see in the near future for the web besides the ability to shop in a more kind of complete way through the web?
It's not just shopping for goods and services, it's shopping for information. I mean, you're going to find out already, you know, when I want to find out the movies that are playing around Silicon Valley, I just go up on the local web page and check it out. It's a lot faster than going to the newspaper, and a lot faster than calling the theaters, et cetera. And more we're shopping for information on the web. I just recently bought a Sony camcorders, you know. I went on Sony's web page and I found out all about the ones they offer and picked the one I wanted right from that web page before I even called a store, you know, to try to find it physically. You know, the demand to get me to buy that thing was created from Sony's web page. And I think we're going to see more and more of that. You're going to be buying information or, you know, finding information and really making a lot of decisions about what you're going to do with your life or what you're going to purchase from the web.
And how did you get into the computer business? What made you think, this is going to be my life?
Well, I met my future partner in Apple, Steve Wozniak, when I was about 13 years old. And he was the first person I'd met that knew more about electronics and computers than I did. And we became fast friends and started to build electronic devices together. We built blue boxes together for a while, which were little devices that could allow you to make free phone calls everywhere. Illegally, I might add.
Oh, so you were a hacker.
Yeah. Yeah, we built the first digital blue box in the whole world. It was wonderful. We had our tagline, which we put a little card in the bottom of each one, was "He's got the whole world in his hand." And the reason we built a computer was that we wanted one and we couldn't afford one. We couldn't afford to buy one. They were thousands of dollars at that time. We were just two teenagers, and so we started trying to build them, and scrounging parts around Silicon Valley where we could. And after a few attempts, we managed to put together something that was the Apple I. And all of our friends wanted them, too. They wanted to build them. So it turned out that it took maybe 50 hours to build one of these things by hand. And it was taking up all of our spare time because our friends were not that skilled at building them. So Woz and I were building them for them. And we thought, if we could just get what's called a printed circuit board where you could kind of just plug in the parts instead of having to hand wire the whole thing, we could cut the assembly time down from, maybe 50 hours to more like, an hour. And so Woz sold his HP calculator and I sold my VW microbus, and we got enough money together to pay someone to design one of these printed circuit boards for us. And our goal was to just sell them as raw printed circuit boards to our friends and make enough money to recoup our calculator and transportation. And what happened was that one of the early computers, matter of fact, the first computer store in the world, which was in Mountain View at the time, said, "Well, I'll take 50 of these computers, but I want them fully assembled," which was a twist that we'd never thought of. So we went and bought the parts to build 100 computers, and we built 50 of them and delivered them. And then we got paid in cash and ran back and paid the people that sold us parts for the parts. And we had the classic Marxian profit realization crisis, which was our profit wasn't liquid. It was in 50 computers sitting on the floor. So we decided we had to start learning about sales and distribution so that we could sell the 50 computers and get back our money. And that's how we got into business.
Do you think that when you were ousted from Apple that people kind of wrote you off?
Oh, golly, I don't know. I'm sure that a lot of people did, and that was fine. It was a very painful time, as you might imagine.
Mm-hmm.
But, you just march forward and you try to learn from it. And one of the things I always tried to coach myself on was not being afraid to fail. When you have something that doesn't work out, a lot of times people's reaction is to get very protective about ever wanting to fall on their face again. And I think that's a big mistake, because you never achieve what you want without falling on your face a few times in the process of getting there. So I've tried to not be afraid to fail. And matter of fact, I've failed quite a bit since leaving Apple.
Are you surprised at the problems Apple is having now, or did you see that coming?
I try not to talk about Apple too much. But what I will say is that the day I left Apple, we had a 10-year lead over Microsoft. And in the technology business, a 10-year lead is really hard to come by. It happens, maybe a company has that once every few decades, whether it be a Xerox or an IBM with mainframes. Apple had that with the graphical user interface. And the problem at Apple was that they stopped innovating. If you look at the Mac that ships today, it's 25% different than the day I left. And that's not enough for 10 years and billions of dollars in R&D. And it wasn't that Microsoft was so brilliant or clever in copying the Mac. It's that the Mac was a sitting duck for 10 years. And that's Apple's problem, is that their differentiation evaporated. And unlike Compaq or others who play in the Intel-Microsoft standard space, where Compaq only has to be 5% better than its competitors for everyone to want to buy their computers, Apple has to be 50 or 100% better, because when you buy something that is, out of the mainstream a little bit, you take a risk, and you want a much bigger reward for taking that risk. And unfortunately, that differentiation has not completely evaporated, but for the most part, it has. And that's the predicament Apple's in now. And that's why, cost-cutting and other things at Apple are not going to be the cure. The cure for Apple is to innovate its way out of its current predicament. And there's a lot of good people left at Apple that are capable of doing that with the proper leadership, which is what's been missing.
Some Mac users are afraid that the Mac operating system is in danger of becoming obsolete in the way that Beta Video became obsolete because it was outdone by VHS. What do you think?
You know, I think with the appropriate leadership at Apple, that's not going to happen. But I think, you know, we're going to have to wait and see.
Do you care? I mean, how still involved, invested do you feel in the future of Apple, the company you co-created?
I'm happy every time a Mac gets shipped. I still have people, you know, sending me emails telling me how much they love their Macs. And it's sort of, how do you explain it? It's like the first person you were ever in love with, you know? It's like your first love, and there will never be another one like it. You know, and in my case, you know, we were together for 10 years, and that's a long time. But, you know, if you move on in your life, you know, you can't always stay in love with your first girlfriend, right?
What do you think the state of the computer would be if it weren't for Apple? This is a chance, I guess, for a really self-serving answer, but I mean, I'm really curious what you think.
I usually believe that if one group of people didn't do something, within a certain number of years, the Times would produce another group of people that would accomplish similar things. We happened to be at the right place, exactly the right time, with the right group of people, and we did some wonderful work. I'm extraordinarily proud of the work that the team at Apple did when I was there. And I think that personally, our major contribution was a little different than some people might think. I think our major contribution was in bringing a liberal arts point of view to the use of computers.
Yeah, explain what you mean by that.
What I mean by that is that, you know, if you really look at the ease of use of the Macintosh, the driving motivation behind that was to bring not only ease of use to people so that many, many more people could use computers for non-traditional things at that time, but it was to bring, you know, beautiful fonts and typography to people. It was to bring graphics to people, not for, you know, plotting laminar flow calculations, but so that they could see beautiful, you know, photographs or pictures or artwork. Our goal was to bring a liberal arts perspective and a liberal arts audience to what it had traditionally been, you know, a very geeky technology and a very geeky audience.
Do you think the PC as we know it is on the verge of changing?
That's a really big question. I think the PC as we know it's going to be around for quite some time, but the heart of the question is, are we entering a time window where we might see the first successful post-PC devices? Personal digital assistants, or PDAs, attempted to be that and failed. And the next attempt is going to be, I think, these very low-cost consumer internet appliances, which is, can somebody make a $300 box that hooks up to your television on one side and maybe hooks up to ISDN or a cable modem on the other side and allows you, you know, for $300 to have a web browser on your TV? And I think that's entirely possible. And I think that we're going to see those devices soon. And hopefully some innovative marketing and distribution techniques surrounding those devices so that, you know, a lot of people can all of a sudden have an internet browser in their living room. And I think that's going to be very exciting.
Steve Jobs speaking with Terry Gross in 1996. Our next guest, Howard Gordon, is a TV writer-producer who's made a specialty out of telling unusual stories in unusual ways. He's written and produced for The X-Files, written for Buffy the Vampire Slayer, Angel, and Beauty and the Beast, and was an executive producer of 24, which featured the high-speed, often highly controversial adventures of counter-terrorist agent Jack Bauer. Gordon's latest series, the Showtime drama Homeland, started this month, and also deals with terrorism and counter-terrorist investigators. But this time, the viewer isn't sure, at least initially, who is the true hero of the story. In this scene from the pilot, a CIA officer is briefing agents on the results of a mission in Afghanistan, which led to the discovery and rescue of a prisoner of war who had been missing and presumed dead for years. The rescued prisoner is Nicholas Brody, played by Damian Lewis. But while watching the video of Brody at the briefing, CIA agent Carrie Matheson, played by Claire Danes, speaks up with a question.
Turns out he's one of ours. Marine Sergeant Nicholas Brody, MIA since early 2003 and presumed dead. Until now.
What happened to his partner? Brody was a scout sniper. They work in pairs. Corporal Thomas Walker also went missing that day.
According to Sergeant Brody, Walker was killed during their captivity. But that shouldn't dampen what is a major win for the agency and for everyone in this room. You should all take a moment. Give yourselves a big hand. Because of you, an American hero is coming home.
What makes Homeland so unusual and so dramatic is that Brody is either a hero or, as Carrie suspects, a double agent who was turned by Al-Qaeda. The show is based very loosely on an Israeli television series and was adapted by Gordon and his longtime writing partner, Alex Ganza. Now, when you signed on for American Rights for it or to adapt it for America, was that the most compelling thing about it for you, the idea of using the POW experience?
The character of Nicholas Brody, a returning veteran, someone who actually had been presumed dead and was now discovered alive 10 years later, was just a really compelling idea for us to ask a lot of questions about the war, the wars, and our response to what happened 10 years ago and how our world has changed, and who better than a returning warrior to explore some of those issues. I mean, it goes back to Odysseus and the Iliad, and, you know, the returning warrior is a staple in literature. And frankly, we were stunned that it wasn't on the air or hadn't really been treated in movies in a way that we felt it needed to be treated. We think the long frame of, Alex and I both talked about this at length, and it really kind of needed a more novelistic approach than even a movie could accommodate. So we loved that character, and we loved the idea reciprocally of a hero on the other side of the table who was trying to stop some bad thing from happening, who herself was unreliable, who herself, you know, whose own account and whose own fears might or might not be valid. Very different from Jack Bauer.
Let's play a clip the first time that they were on opposite sides of a table from the premiere episode of Homeland. It's the first time that the returning POW, Marine Sergeant Nicholas Brody, comes face-to-face with CIA officer Carrie Matheson. Everyone else at the debriefing, including her boss, played by David Harewood, sees Brody as a hero, but Carrie suspects he may be a traitor, and after a softball introduction, questions him accordingly. Damian Lewis plays Brody. Claire Danes plays Carrie.
My name is Carrie Matheson. I served as a case officer in Iraq. Your picture was on our MIA wall. I saw it every day for 5 years. It's good to meet you in person.
Thank you, ma'am.
I'm sorry we were unable to find you sooner.
I appreciate that.
I'd like to start with the first few days of your captivity, if you don't mind.
Not at all.
How soon after you were taken did the interrogations begin?
Pretty much right away.
What did they want to know?
Anything I could tell them about U.S. ground operations? Supply routes, communication codes, rules of engagement.
When you were debriefed in Germany, you said you gave up no such information.
My SEER training was excellent.
And Corporal Walker?
Ma'am?
Did he give anything up?
We were never interrogated together, so I don't know.
But still, you must have wondered, especially after you learned of his death.
I'm assuming there's a point to all this, Carrie.
Well, there is, sir. As you know, the first 72 hours after a soldier's capture are critical. What he knows can be used by the enemy during that period to devastating effect. The point is, Sergeant Brody stopped being a source of actionable intelligence fairly quickly, and yet he was kept alive for almost 8 more years. I'd like to ask him if he knows why.
I often wondered that myself.
If you're just joining us, our guest is Howard Gordon, one of the executive producers and writers of the new Showtime drama series Homeland. Can you talk about the subtlety of the acting and the reacting in that clip?
Well, it's a very tricky and very high-stakes game of poker that's happening here because Carrie has got this suspicion that she's not shared with her superiors, so she can't show her hand. He obviously cannot show his to the extent that he has one, although we do learn in a privileged point of view that he has a memory that shows that he's lying. So as it turns out, the hunted and the hunter, and you know, are at the same time very much alike as people. Psychologically, they're both very broken people. They're both veterans of the same war, and they're both damaged. But the two of them are just spectacular. I mean, we pinch ourselves every day to have Damian and Claire heading up the cast.
I've previewed the first three episodes, and for the first three episodes, except for a scene or two, Brody and Carrie are kept apart, and yet they are so together for those first three episodes because she sets up surveillance equipment and watches him, and he's usually alone. So they're sharing this alone time together. I thought that was not only a fascinating structure, but clearly one that you had to do intentionally and for a reason. So what's the reason?
Well, the reason was to develop a sort of lopsided intimacy from Carrie. Carrie is this person who's given up the idea of having a family, let alone even a loving relationship. And as she watches and invades the privacy, and by the way, the constitutionally guaranteed privacy of this family, she winds up becoming attached in a very voyeuristic way. And, you know, Alex and I discussed some inspirations like, Rear Window and The Lives of Others and The Conversation. That really was it. And what's the price of this invasion of other people's privacy? What does it do to the watcher?
There are a couple of scenes where she is watching something on surveillance. I don't want to say what it is, but where she decides that she doesn't want to watch it anymore and literally turns the monitor away so she can't see it. And it is during the scenes where Brody is with his wife, played by Marina Baccarin, if I'm pronouncing her name correctly.
That's right.
And it is when they are the most intimate. They're in the bedroom. Carrie has installed a camera in there. So we are seeing what I think we are meant to believe is the only time where Brody really lets his guard completely drop is when he is having physical relations with his wife. But these relations, it's an emotional intimacy, not just physical. And sometimes it's more violent, it's more distant, and it's creepy. But viewers are still voyeuristically drawn into the same scene. And it sort of makes us complicit in a way that I thought Alfred Hitchcock used to do. And again, what are the lines that you're trying to draw about how the audience is supposed to perceive this and accept it and want to see or not see these different images and scenes?
Yeah, well, you're hitting exactly on something that Alex and I talked about at length, that this really is a series about perception. And in some ways, you know, frames how people are framing other people with their expectations. And of course, at the biggest level, here's Nicholas Brody, who's greeted by the public, and he's on inside the frame of the television as this great hero home from the hill who actually is groomed for political office later. So he's this charismatic, perfect family with this dramatic story. From the privacy of Carrie's voyeuristic, invasion of their privacy, we're seeing this awful drama unfold in the privacy. I think the thing you're referring to is a very uncomfortable. You know, we created about as uncomfortable a moment as one can imagine, that you feel yourself wanting to turn away but compelled to stay watching. And so the audience is complicit, as you described, in this voyeurism as well. So we also are treated to these subjective views of Nicholas Brody imagining or remembering his own past and filling in for us the story of what happened to him while he was there, while he was a captive. But is that real, or is that, you know, how reliable is memory itself? So it really is about perception, about perspective, and about this, where are the fault lines between all those points of views.
What are American TV viewers ready for now in this subject? What do you most want to explore politically?
Well, Alex and I really thought about this again. We thought obviously we want to make a compelling and entertaining thriller first and foremost, but there were a lot of ideas that we felt we wanted to accommodate. And again, none of them, we didn't want them to be a polemic or at all propaganda or try to use this as a platform to make any points, except that the world after 9/11 and 10 years after these two wars and after we've revised and adapted the way we conduct our wars and our image abroad, that those are questions, that are very complex. What does it mean to be a hero? What's the price of war? Why are we fighting? What are we fighting for? How are we treating our veterans? What do we have to be afraid of? And those were questions that don't have any easy answers. So we just wanted to ask a lot of questions, and questions that say, you know, during 24, things seemed a little clearer. Our fear was a little more pitched, and our idea of who was good and who was bad, you know, a little, you know, maybe a little clearer. But at the same time, that was 10 years ago.
Well, Howard Gordon, thanks for being on Fresh Air.
Thank you so much, David.
Howard Gordon is the executive producer and co-creator of Homeland, which is televised Sunday nights on Showtime. Earlier this week, Mitt Romney called the Occupy Wall Street protests an act of class warfare. Our linguist, Jeff Nunberg, thinks it's curious that that phrase is still around while the rest of the jargon of Marxism has largely disappeared from public life.
Class warfare was a dodgy phrase from the outset. In one of the most famous sentences in the history of political thought, Marx and Engels wrote in their 1848 Communist Manifesto, "The history of all society up to now is the history of," and that's where things get complicated. In the original German, they wrote Klassenkämpfen, which means class struggles, but some of their critics rendered it more belligerently as class warfare. That was the stock label they put on the bearded socialist agitator in political cartoons. And some socialists actually did use the phrase, while others tried to turn it around to describe the capitalist oppression of labor. But warfare more readily suggested the disorderly violence that broke out from below. It conjured up the red flags, cloth caps, and barricades of Les Mis, not the measured operations of the parliaments and law courts on the side of the bourgeoisie. It was those violent overtones that endeared class warfare to the right and spared it the fate of Marxist jargon like proletariat, class struggle, and the masses. Even the left has bailed on those expressions. They're only about a quarter as common in the pages of the New Left Review as they were in the 1970s. But class warfare has been on a tear in the language of the right. It's used five times as often in the Wall Street Journal now as it was 40 years ago. In fact, the phrase has actually become more frequent as the marginal tax rates went down. It's sort of a revenant, a specter that haunts the English language whenever appeals for making the rich pay more are heard in the land. Like other dead metaphors, it has to be said just so. It's class warfare, not class war, which sounds disconcertingly European, where class isn't a forbidden subject. In a speech to the Labour Party conference in 1999, Tony Blair famously announced, "The class war is over." You wonder how people would have responded if Bill Clinton had said that. What, there was a war? In fact, class warfare is just about the only phrase in American political discourse where class can appear without the all-forgiving prefix middle. People who level the charge of class warfare never go to the logical next step to extol the virtues of class cooperation. That would imply that there actually are classes in America and would undermine the ideal of a land of opportunity. As the story goes, there are only two kinds of Americans: those who are already rich, and those who expect to be. That's why Americans won't tolerate those tax-the-rich proposals that pit one group against another, when we should all be in it together. Democrats react by dismissing the charge as a tired Republican talking point, or trying to turn it around the way the old socialists did. During the 2000 election, Al Gore described the Bush tax program as class warfare on behalf of billionaires. But the charge does tend to put Democrats on the defensive. As President Obama said when he announced his tax program, "This is not class warfare, it's math." But that doesn't always work in politics, where denials are apt to raise suspicions rather than dispel them. As in, "I did not have sexual relations with that woman," or "I am not a crook." Yet these days, the C word isn't quite as off limits as it used to be. Maybe because the populist genie has been let out of the bottle. In a speech the day after he announced his tax ideas, Obama said, "If asking a billionaire to pay the same rate as a plumber or teacher makes me a warrior for the middle class, I wear that charge as a badge of honor." That may be just stump speechifying, but it also makes him the first Democratic politician who has ever accepted the label and invoked the rhetoric of war against the rich. The tone is different on the right, too. The Republican leadership still warn against divisiveness and avoid talking about class explicitly, other than saying that we shouldn't be increasing taxes on the job creators, but rather broadening the base. But the conservative media and bloggers have been less circumspect about cleaving society in two. Some of them talk about an all-out war between the producer class and the moocher class. And Fox Business News ran a series of segments last spring called Entitlement Nation, Makers versus Takers. It isn't entirely clear exactly who the moochers and takers are, but everybody seems to define them as including the 51% of American households who don't pay federal income taxes, along with people who receive Pell Grants and other forms of government assistance. This isn't just about a couple of welfare queens anymore. It actually recalls another famous sentence from the Communist Manifesto. Society is splitting more and more into two enemy camps, into a face-off between two huge classes. It's true that Marx and Engels would have wanted to draw the line a little differently and rearrange those maker and taker place cards. And of course, they were rooting for a different team. Still, they all share the same basic theory of class conflict as the motor force of history. It puts me in mind of what an Italian friend of mine once said. America, what a country. You have everything in America. You have mechanical bulls. You have early bird specials. You can even find Marxists in America. He's right about that, and in the damnedest places, too.
Jeff Nunberg is a linguist who teaches at the School of Information at the University of California, Berkeley. You can find links related to his commentary on our website, freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air Weekend was produced by John Sheehan. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Sharrock, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, John Myers, Heidi Simon, and Teresa Madden. Our administrative assistant is Dorothy Farabee. Melody Kramer is our associate producer for online media. For Terry Gross, I'm David Biancooley.